Hey there, come on in. It's time for Write Club. The first rule of Write Club is we don't talk about Write Club, but for you, we're breaking the rule.
Hello and welcome to Write Club, the podcast for writers and readers everywhere. Hi, I'm Pat, and today I'm joined by Teresa.
Hi.
Nicola.
Hello.
Linda.
Hey there.
And Steph.
Hi there.
This week on Write Club, we're going to be talking about playwriting. And for that, we'll be joined by Amanda Staples, whose award-winning play, Western on a Sunday, has just finished a successful run at a theatre in Bristol. Before that, Teresa will be sharing an excerpt from her play, Dwarf Elephants, with us, assisted by a stellar cast of actors, namely us. Steph will be talking about some very interesting words. And finally, Teresa and Kate Cocker will be telling us what's on their bedside tables. Kate is a friend of the podcast and is known as the presenter coach. She works with presenters of radio, stage and screen. But before all that, Steph is going to ask us to
name the novel.
Right, are you ready?
Yes.
Ready?
Oh.
Okay, clue number one. This book won the Commonwealth Writers' Prize for Best Book of 1995.
No, that's fairly born.
Best Book of 1995.
No.
Do you
know
where in 1995?
Yes, I do. I was having Phoebe.
Okay, clue number two then. The opening line, Dr. Yanis had enjoyed a satisfactory day in which none of his patients had died or got any worse.
Oh, what's it called?
Is it? Yes, I think.
Write it down.
Yeah, but I will when I remember the name. I will when I remember the name of it. That's annoying.
Welcome to my world.
Well, I haven't read that many of these. British novel.
Okay, clue one. Number three then. Has anybody written anything down?
Well, I've got it.
I've written it in my head.
Clue number two was the opening line was Dr. Yanis had enjoyed a satisfactory day in which none of his patients had died or got any worse. Yeah. Clue number three, the hero is a young Italian army officer who is posted to Kefalonia in Greece where the story is set.
Even I know this one.
Yay!
Nicola.
It's Captain Corelli's Mandolin.
Yay!
Oh. There it is. Harry Batter's old copy.
Is it 1995?
1995, yeah.
We've got that copy. Not a clue. I'm never going to get a point.
Aww. You haven't read it?
I've seen the movie.
The movie's different. Yeah. They changed the ending in the movie.
Oh. Well, I'll have to read the book then.
I'm handing it over to you now.
Well, this is going to be
number, check my name's inside.
Number 26 or so on my list.
Well, I think we ought to go back and score up the first 10 episodes because you got many more than me in the many more, fewer, less.
No, I got many more.
She got more. Yeah.
More than you.
More than me in the first 10 episodes. Mm.
Yeah, but you know, but my problem is that I haven't read that many of the British novels.
Great British novels.
Great British novels. and then the only ones I'm familiar with are the ones I do. So I'll never score.
Now, have we said who wrote Captain Corelli's Mandolin?
No, I don't think so.
I don't think we have.
Louis de Bernier. That's right. Okay. Yeah. I wasn't sure that we'd said that.
Okay. Well, thank you for that, Steph.
You're welcome.
How many points do we have now?
Well, who scored? Everybody scored a point on that one.
Mm, really?
Everybody got it on the second
me,
clue.
Second.
Right, so Teresa and Pat got 2 points.
Neck and neck.
And Nicola got one. And Linda.
None. Zero.
Okay. So last time, I think Teresa was on 6, Pat was on 3, I was on 2, Nicola and Linda were on 0. So now Teresa is on 8. Pat's on 5, I'm on 2, Nicola's on 1, and Linda's on 0.
Come on, Linda. Catch
up next time. No, I need to be the foundation way down there on the bottom.
Well,
We have a bit of a departure from our usual offering today. As I said at the start of the show, we're going to hear from Teresa's play, Dwarf Elephants. Teresa, would you like to set the scene for us?
Well, the inspiration for this play was a walking holiday I had on the Greek island of Kythera. I was there with about a large group of about 15 people, and we stayed in this lovely accommodation, which was a house with bedrooms, living room, kitchen, bathroom. And then on the courtyard, there were three more bedrooms, another kitchen, another bathroom. And we spent all our time in the courtyard when we weren't walking. And it seemed like a natural stage. And I had the idea that I'd like to write a play in that setting. And then I thought about, well, how would I populate this space? And I thought three couples would be a nice number of actors and a nice mix of characters. Then I had to have a reason for them being on Kythera. So I thought the reason that they might be there would be for a wedding. So that's the basic idea where this came from. And in this scene, we just have the first, first of all, two characters, then Katie comes in, and then Bill comes in at the end. So we're only getting part of the cast in this short excerpt, but it's the opening scene. So it starts with a couple, Martha and Peter, and then the second couple are Katie and Bill that come in. Over to you, my wonderful actors.
I'd have liked more time to get into character, but I'll do my best.
Okay.
Just think motivation.
Channel my inner Bill.
Yeah, okay.
Isn't this lovely, Peter? It's like something from a holiday brochure.
It's all right. Bit primitive. I'm not so keen on the outside levee.
It's not outside, it's just off the courtyard. It's charming.
Like I said, primitive.
You're not in a hotel. It's their holiday home. I think it's wonderful. They're so lucky.
At least in our holiday home, you get some privacy.
Well, this isn't Betsy Coyard, is it?
I'll have to get my slippers and dressing gown on every time I need a wee. You can't go wandering around naked either.
As if I would. Anyway, stop moaning.
Here we are. Have you tried ouzo before?
Oh, no, never. Not too strong for me.
Try anything once.
Well, cheers and welcome to Kythera.
Bottoms up.
Cheers, Katie. It's wonderful to be here and so lovely of you to invite us.
Well, there are plenty of hotels on the island, but I thought it would be nice to spend some time together before the wedding. How is your room?
Oh, it's perfect. You've really got an eye for decor. Everything's so tasteful.
Actually, I wasn't responsible for the renovation. Most of it was done before my time, though I've added a few touches.
Oh, can't seem to get a phone signal.
Sorry about that. You'll have to go out and across the road and use your mobile. And we've no landline either. We're only here a couple of times a year, so it's not worth it.
How do you keep in touch?
We don't. We like being off the radar for a week or two.
Ridiculous.
We're on holiday. We're here to socialise. You'll manage.
Suppose I'll have to.
Sorry about Peter. He's a bit set in his ways.
I should have explained about the phones. I think there might be Wi-Fi in the village taverna. I thought we'd eat there tonight. If you don't mind, we can check.
Oh, that sounds lovely. We'd love to. Is that the one by the church?
Yes.
Where the wedding will be?
Yes, it's really lovely inside. The church, I mean.
Peter and I are so pleased that Harry's marrying Alexandra. She's such a lovely girl and so bright. You must be very proud of her.
Well, yes, I am, but didn't Bill explain?
Sorry?
Alexandra isn't my daughter. We've only been married 4 years.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
That's okay.
Oh, I feel such a fool.
Really, it's a very natural mistake. Forget it. And you're right, Lexi is a lovely girl. We're practically best friends.
So Bill's first wife
is due any time now with her current boyfriend.
And where will they be staying?
That bedroom over there.
What? You mean they're staying here with you?
Yes, of course. It's not a problem.
Really? Well, I must say you're very relaxed about it.
Why shouldn't I be? It's really not a problem. We're all quite civilized.
Just, you know, it might be a bit uncomfortable, all under one roof, so to speak.
I promise you, it won't be.
I just found this book in the bedroom. I've been reading about some waterfalls, some lovely photos, and I've been reading about the history of the island.
If the weather's warm, we might go there. You can swim in the pools below the waterfalls.
Oh, we didn't bring any swimmers, did we, Peter?
What?
We didn't think it would be this hot in October.
Well, it's very secluded. If you feel like a discreet skinny dip.
Oh, I've never done that. What do you think, Peter?
What about?
Having a swim without corsets.
Have you gone completely insane?
I can't see any harm in it. Don't be such a stick in the mud.
Don't give my wife any more ouzo.
Oh, if you insist.
Cheers, Martha. Never mind. I wonder where Bill can have got to.
Is it far to the supermarket?
No, he's probably stopped off for a drink somewhere.
This courtyard is lovely.
Yes. This is my favourite part of the house.
That plant's beautiful.
Oh, the angel's trumpet. I don't know how it survives when there's no one here to water it most of the year.
Do you think it would grow in England? Maybe I could take a cutting. Mm.
You'd better ask Bill. I've heard it's...
Well, this should keep us going for a while. All settling in nicely.
Yes, thanks, Bill.
What took you so long? See if anyone needs a drink, will you?
Your wish is my command. Are you ready for another, Martha?
Oh, not yet, thanks. Tastes lovely, but it's very strong, isn't it? I feel a bit light-headed already.
Peter?
Oh, I think I'll switch to beer, if I may. That ouzo is giving people strange ideas.
No problem. Just let me put these in the fridge and I'll get you a cold one.
Watch out for my husband, Martha. He's a pathological flirt.
Oh, I think he's lovely. I mean, charming.
He thinks so too.
Good one, Katie.
I'm sure he doesn't mean anything by it.
He doesn't. It's just a habit.
I don't mind.
She likes the attention.
There you go, Peter. Now, what are we talking about?
Thanks. Your wife was just saying.
My wife? God, there'll be two of them soon.
We were admiring your lovely home.
Have you been to Greece before?
No, never.
We've got a place of our own in North Wales.
On a caravan park.
It's not a caravan, it's a lodge.
Well, you couldn't tow it, but...
How lovely. Do you go there a lot?
Well, most weekends in the summer and always a fortnight in August.
But we do go abroad as well.
Do we?
Honestly, Peter, remember that coach trip to Yugoslavia?
How long ago was that?
About 30 years. It's not even called Yugoslavia anymore.
It was lovely.
No, it wasn't. You've forgotten that horrible journey, 3 days on a bus, I ask you.
Fascinating culture, Katie.
It must have been quite an experience to visit a communist country.
And don't forget Malta, the Mediterranean cruise.
Oh, yes.
I took her on a cruise for our silver wedding anniversary.
Cruises, eh? The high life. You know how to treat a lady, Peter.
Wasn't exactly the QE2.
But I'm sure it was fun anyway.
Not really. There was nearly a mutiny. Everybody got food poisoning.
I was fine.
Oh, apart from St. Peter of the cast iron stomach, obviously. The captain was drunk all the time. He crashed into a harbour wall.
You must have been terrified.
At least they were apt to bonded. I got all my money back, so it was in effect a free holiday.
But your poor wife.
All part of life's rich tapestry, eh, my love?
He always says that.
No such dramas at Betty Sill Cood.
No, it's very tranquil.
It's a...
Can you say Betsy Cohen?
You can't have that going on.
As soon as you go there and it's your holiday home, you probably
know it's called Betsy.
No, you've ruined my mood, I'm going to have to get right back into character.
Oh, the characterisation's killing me. Oh my God. This is what I mean about taking it to another level with actors.
No, stop, otherwise I won't be able to carry on. Right, where were we?
We need to talk about that.
No such dramas at Betsy Cohen.
Betsy Cohen. No such dramas at Betsy Coed.
No, it's very tranquil.
It's a beautiful area. I love North Wales.
Have you been, Bill?
Do you know, I've never even been to Wales.
Oh, you must come, mustn't they, Peter?
Oh, you must. It's a luxury lodge, you know, with 2 double bedrooms, both en suite.
We'd love to, wouldn't we, dear?
Any bank holiday weekend. Just give us a call.
Or send us an email. They even have internet in Wales these days.
Peter.
You can't beat having your own place for holidays, can you, Bill?
I wasn't sure what you were going to say. Well, brilliant. That just, the actors just take it to another dimension, don't they? And it becomes something you didn't know it was. So lovely, lovely interpretation. Really, really good effort to characterise it.
I've got a sore throat for trying to be Bill. How about you, Pete?
I was concentrating on the more pedantic side of my nature.
Definitely came across. That was absolutely brilliant. Well done. Well done, Martha and Katie as well. So, critique.
Well, I just thought it was great, and I liked the humour in it, and I thought, I think Martha's a great character. I love her. She's a kind of Penelope Keith. A Good Life.
Yes.
She's very Penelope Keith.
Yeah. There were definitely shades of Abigail's Party going on.
Yeah.
Did you write it with that in mind, or did you want it to be humorous?
It's not just a comedy. It's meant to be a comedy, but as I say, that's the thing. When you give it, and we talk about this with Amanda Staples in the interview later, but when you give it to actors, then they take it somewhere else. It becomes something else, and it's that thing about leave it. You have to be aware writing a script that other people are going to be involved, actors, directors, lighting and sound and costume and all of these things are going to create the final thing.
But actually, I think the strength of that is there is some really good characterisation which gives actors or directors plenty to latch on to.
I did have one thought here about Martha, because it seems that in the beginning here, when we're talking about the ex-wife coming and she's concerned, what, they're staying here with you? It'd be very uncomfortable. Sounds a little prudish. And then just a few lines down, she's talking about going swimming without cubbies. Mm. And I wondered if...
Uzo.
It was a...
The Uzo factor.
That's the Uzo factor.
I just felt it was a rather rapid switch from that. But,
okay, that's something to think about. Yeah. But, I do have this idea of Martha that she is quite adventurous, but that Peter's holding her back or has held her back for many a year.
Right.
Let's face it, he'd have to, wouldn't he?
Yeah.
I
think that comes across.
I've just glanced at the character notes for Bill, which says Bill is a sophisticated cosmopolitan Greek, charming, charismatic, sensitive, quite cold. Now, I didn't actually play him like that at all.
No, you didn't.
So
a Greek accent would have been good.
A Greek accent would have been great.
Well, it's not necessary because my
Also, I didn't feel he was cold. Because you said charming cosmopolitan, essentially quite cold. I didn't feel from the words that he was speaking that he was cold.
But I think maybe this will come out.
There's not very much of him in this.
No, I know that's probably
what, as you say, will come out later.
Yeah.
When we see him in relation to...
I really enjoyed doing it.
Yeah, I was dreading it, but I...
You're throwing yourself into it. You've missed a vocation there. We're going to get you in the Andram.
I often think that, darling.
Yes, so you're going to join the Andram. That's it now.
That was great.
Thank you, everyone.
Now, Steph, you want to talk to us about some interesting words that you've encountered?
I've been looking up interesting words, and actually on the Greek theme from that play, I think all of us here are bibliophiles. Lovers of books, which comes from the Greek biblion, which means paper, document, tablet or book, and philos, beloved. And some of us may even admit to being a bibliophage. That's... from the Greek biblio book and the phagein, which is related to Latin meaning feeding on, and Greek meaning eater of, or literally to share food.
Yeah.
So a bibliophage would be somebody who devours books, literally or figuratively.
Right.
So an avid reader or a bookworm, and I'll own up to that one too. Mm-hmm. And most of us are logophiles, that's lover of words, which is from the Greek logos for words and philos, beloved.
Mm-hmm.
So that's part of being a writer, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But how many of us are librocubicularists?
Not when I ask
you. You do that and you'll tell me that.
So what percentage of the population do you think perhaps might be a librocubicularist?
Well... When
the
you
reading
tell us what
population.
It means, yeah.
Okay. Well, I've got a confession to make. As much to my husband's irritation, I am and I suspect I'm not alone, because it's from the Latin liber, which is book, and the Latin cubiculum, from cubo, to lie down, we get the word bedroom.
I just wonder if it was to do with leaving them hanging around.
No, a libro cubicularist is a person who reads in bed.
Oh!
And this week I came across a peculiar subset of libro cubicularists.
Finally.
Because there are libro cubicularists who sport a ballycumber. And what's a ballycumber, I hear you ask? Well, it's a town in the south of Ireland on the river Brosna, but it's also, perhaps of more interest, is what Douglas Adams, the author of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, defined as one of the six half-read books lying somewhere in your bed. So a ballycumber is one, just one of the six half-read books. But only six, Mr. Adams. I think I can go a few better than that. My ballycumber's bigger than yours. Before I finish on the subject of wordy words, I want to say a big hello to the Ballycumber Book Club. It's a book club for people who never actually finish. And I contacted them, and their spokesperson told me that they're not meeting at the moment because a lot of their members are teachers and they're all a bit hectic. But they hope to start up again soon. Yeah, I hope they are too. So here's a shout out to all of you, and why not send us a review of your ballycumbers on your bedside table? If you look on our Facebook page, you'll be able to find details of how you can do that.
There is two things of worrying that worry me about that whole piece. One is that you would, as a completer finisher, that anyone could not finish a book. And the second one is that people could have books unfinished lying about in their beds.
You're the sci-fi fan. It was Mr. Douglas
Adams. That's right.
Yeah. You're a tidy person.
Oh, yes.
Well, I can see that if she walked into Stephanie's bedroom, she would be nuts, and she would have to read the rest of every book that's on the bed before she could sleep.
Yeah. You're not allowed out of bed till you finish.
Well, thank you, Steph. You've given us all a lot to think about there. Now, as promised, we have a guest on this week's show, Amanda Staples. Amanda lives in Bristol and has had various short stories published. She's previously been placed in a novel writing competition and was long-listed for the National Novel Writing Competition last January. Today, she's reading from her play, Western on a Sunday, and then we'll be discussing writing for the stage.
Welcome to Write Club, the podcast. Tell us a bit about Amanda Staples.
Okay. So a bit like Stephanie, on your first podcast, I heard you mention that you started writing plays when you were a child, and it made you remember that that's what I did. I put my family through some dire productions, I'm sure, that a lot of which were improvised and went on for far too long, and we raided my auntie's wardrobe and looked like I don't know what. So drag queens probably. So that's how I started. But in reality, I think proper writing I started in my 20s. Behind me is a cupboard full of folders I can't look at without at least a bottle of whiskey, because they just feel hideous to me. But without them, I wouldn't have ditched it all, got into my 30s and started all over again. And that's when the play was written. There's several bits of novels around, as I think every writer's got. Last year, I really started sending out short stories, and there quite a few of those got taken up. I read at the Bath Literary Festival with a group called Talking Tales, and I read with them again in December in a more local event in the centre of Bristol. So that was really good. And I've been on a couple of other podcasts, but other people have recorded my stories and read them, which has been lovely. And then the play went on in Croydon last year and Bristol this year. So it's all picking up. The last sort of 2 years have been quite proactive and good in amongst the rejections, which you get, but it's all fine.
So the play we're talking about here is Western on a Sunday.
Yes.
That was on in Croydon last year and has been produced in Bristol this year. Tell us a bit about Western on a Sunday and what your inspiration for that was.
Western on Sunday was really kind of inspired by my nan to an extent, because she had vascular Alzheimer's, which she died of. And with vascular Alzheimer's, you get some quite particular and nasty degenerations through the end of it that's quite different to people with standard dementia. So she mini-stroked a lot towards the end, so she was quite difficult towards the end. And I wanted to show the sort of downward spiral before that point, when they know they're kind of losing their mind, and then they forget they are, and then they realise they are, and then they forget they are, and how people cope. So in the play, you've got her son, who doesn't cope very well, the neighbour, who copes marvellously, and the play is on a day when Peggy is being moved into a home, which she's been told countless times, but keeps forgetting. And someone has come in to view the house, and she mistakes that person for her daughter and someone that she's worked with. And the woman has no idea what's going on. Eventually she works out there's something not quite right. So what I wanted to do was just bring in some comedy without making a mockery of the condition, because people look at dementia and Alzheimer's and think it's very bleak. And of course it is, particularly towards the end. But I laugh with my nan an awful lot over all manner of things that she would come out with. And she would laugh with me. I'm not quite sure if she knew why she was being funny, but you know, we cope through joy, and I wanted to bring that into the play as well. So there are two direct quotes from her in there. Thanks, Mum. But the rest is just inspired around her behaviour and activity, and watching my family interact with her and other people, actually. So,
brilliant. Yeah. Brilliant. Okay. So for you then, what came first? You may have answered this already, but what came first for you? Was it stories, novels, or plays?
Probably short stories, which I just didn't really like. I think it took me a while to realise I was quite descriptive and wordy, so short stories were not really the best way to do that. But I moved into novels and still had the same problem. I was too descriptive. So I went back to short stories to learn how to stop doing that, and then moved back into plays and novels. So kind of back and forth a little bit between all three.
I was going to say, following on from that, when you get an idea, a germ of an idea, how do you know if it's a story or a play?
Oh, no. Generally, by getting a pen out. I generally start handwriting. I don't type well straight onto a screen. It's quite rare, unless I'm already there and I just get something. Sometimes I'll start and I'll think, oh, this is going to be a, and I'll start, and it will either go in a completely different direction or nowhere at all. Other times I've got something in my head and it'll roll around like a ball bearing in a machine, and I think, I'm not sure what that even is, but it won't go away. And if it doesn't go away, and that happens for several days, I give in and I write something down. And it may just be a line or a paragraph, or it may just actually develop itself out. So, yeah, generally, until I get it on a piece of paper in front of me, I don't necessarily know what it is. It just becomes its own beast eventually.
So with Western on Sunday, did that start off always going to be a play?
It started off, I think at the time I was working with a friend, and we used to write all manner of weird things. And we had this idea of getting into the radio, which is really, really hard, and we've never managed it. So we decided to write some radio stuff. And then I just developed Westmore Sunday as a radio play. So that's how it started off about 10 or 15 years ago, and then just got shelved because nobody was interested. And then more recently, I just rewrote it. Well, I rewrote it as a one act play to enter it into a competition, where it got third place and highly commended. And that was really lovely. And then so it went on last year as a one act. But the guy that took it up to go on in Bristol wanted it rewritten to a full length play. So I had to kind of delve a bit deeper into the inspirations and expand it by about 10 or 15 pages. So that was fun. Yeah.
Quite a long, slow process to get to where it is today.
Yeah, it's been hanging around a while, that one. So it's nice to see it come to life, really. Yeah.
Were you involved in theatre before you actually started writing the play?
No, I've been, obviously. I go to theatre. I like it. I go to lots of different things. I go to the fringe stuff. So in Bristol, we've got a couple of big theatres like the Hippodrome, the massive ones, the smaller ones like Redgrave, and places like the Armour Tavern and Wardrobe, which are fringe theatres. And they're great, and they have some fantastic stuff on. And actually, the guys who put the play on in Croydon last year, I went to watch them do Pinter's Dumb Waiter, and just went up to them afterwards and said, I don't suppose you take unsolicited manuscripts, do you? And then it took a year after that. So, yeah, so I have no acting skills. I can't act. I was involved with the production of the one in Bristol, and I went to workshops and the rehearsals, and a few times I had to stand in and read, and I was so wooden. I was like, and I just didn't know what to do. And the director's like, just relax. I'm like, I am relaxed. So until we got the cast in place, I was not happy. I was like, can we just pick people so I don't have to keep doing this? So yeah, I'm not an actor at all, and I couldn't direct either. Watching the director do it and bring people to life was a phenomenal experience. You know, seeing something on the page, hearing it in my head, and then seeing someone do it and go, oh, that's so much better than what I wrote. You know, it's just and then someone made me cry, and I'm crying, and I wrote that. Oh, that's brilliant. You know, so so yeah, I've got huge respect for people that do tread the boards or in the wings. I've got my friend who I call the props queen. She'll hate that. Hello, Anne. She's a backstage assistant. She does stage management. She's fantastic, and she kept me sane through the process because I didn't really quite know what I was getting into until I was bang in the middle of it. So, yeah,
It's interesting because, you know, you say that, you know, the actors kind of made it something you weren't expecting or better. When you're writing, are you conscious of leaving space for the actors and other creatives, the props people and the director?
I wasn't initially. I am now. Yeah, very much so. But I did say to the director when he took it on, I said, I'm not one of these precious people, because he said, you can come to the workshops and speak all you like. You can come to rehearsals and not speak at all. So
obviously worked with play arts before.
Yes, but I said to him, I'm not precious. If people want to change stuff, he's taken out a lot of my stage directions and things. He said they're just not necessary. Let the actors do their own thing. And particularly with Peggy, the lady who played Peggy in the second lot, she was fantastic. And watching her just ad-lib some of the confusion was phenomenal. She was brilliant. So I'm not precious about rewrites. I've learned to take criticism. I welcome criticism, actually, because I think it makes you a better writer. And what you produce to be hopefully better. So yes, I did say straight off, don't change the essence, but feel free to play with it.
That's good. So do you think in the future you'll be writing less stage directions and leaving it a bit more open for the actors?
I think so, and actually from what I heard from people that I know in the profession, they tend to, even if you write them, they tend to ignore them anyway. So they tend to just throw them out the window and do their own thing. And actually, if you go and see, I don't know, three different productions of Midsummer Night's Dream, they'll all be completely different, and they're all from the same text. So yeah, it makes sense. I think just to put some minimal things, and if they matter, you know, like Exit Pursued by Bear, you really need that in there, don't you? But if it's just something like Fiddle With This, you don't need necessarily to have that in there. So.
Although you don't do much in the way of stage directions, or you won't do in the future, what about character notes?
I tend to work backwards, and I've tried not to do this because it's quite frustrating and stressful, but I tend to get into a character first and then think, okay, who am I now? And I'll work back and I'll think, so, okay, this is Peggy. I know she's old, but how old is she? Okay, she's 80-something probably. Where's she come from? No idea. Probably should think about that. What did she do before? Don't know. Probably should think about that. So I tend to get someone and work backwards. And the novel I've just written, I was determined that the woman, you know, the protagonist was going to be a woman. And I got two chapters in and kept writing a man's name. I'm like, okay, I'll change it then, shall I? But I didn't know who he was. I was like, this is fine, but I don't know who you are now, so that's not helpful. So I've had to go and recreate a whole new character who is central, because that's the protagonist, and start again. But yeah, I think you go with an intuition. Well, I go with an intuition of somebody and then think, right, this feels comfy. I'm in their skin. What is their skin? And sometimes I don't even know what they look like. I'm not one of these people that writes, they've got brown eyes and red hair and stuff. It's not always particularly helpful, but I just need an essence of, I think, because I've got a background in psychology because I'm a clinical hypnotherapist. I get in their psychology first, and then I layer up, you know, where they're from, their background.
Mm-hmm. How does that work itself into a character in the play?
The psychology?
Well, the whole process, really, of revealing that character.
It was really to focus on the emotion. So particularly with the play, I really wanted it to be emotional, not necessarily upsetting. I mean, it is. It's, we've got sort of racism in there and all sorts because of what she would have, the phrases she would have used back in the day would have been okay that aren't acceptable now. So we've got all sorts of things that she regresses into that are very inappropriate and they're designed to be shocking. But we can't have her told off because she doesn't understand. So there's an element that we have to almost treat her like a child, but without being particularly condescending. I'll try not to. And people don't always get that right in the play. There are times when she gets extraordinarily frustrated, but even she doesn't necessarily know why. So we have to try and demonstrate that through other people's reaction and then how they deal with her. And of course, I think really what I was looking for with the play was just to get the emotional aspect on all of those different people, especially the person that knows nothing about Peggy, who comes in as a complete stranger. Mm-hmm. Who Peggy is convinced that's her daughter, she has to either just go, right, I'm going, because this is just too weird, or she stays and plays along and she has to find a way to do that. And that's through judging Peggy's emotion and how she's going to keep her calm until someone comes and saves her, you know, which the neighbour comes in and does. Mm-hmm. So I really just wanted to use emotion, I think, through that.
Brilliant. That's excellent. Thank you, Amanda. Now, you said, we talked about you doing quick reading, and you said because of the way it is, and because a lot of the comedy comes through the visual stuff, that a reading might not be that appropriate. But you said you do have a piece of dialogue you could read to us.
Yes, I have.
Is there a piece of dialogue that you could read and then talk to us a bit about the visual that went around it? Or
there's not too much visual in this. There's bits and pieces. It's really how Peggy is. It's her facial expressions a lot throughout, as much as it's quite difficult to describe. But I'll do my best.
Okay, here you go then. Thank you.
This is, Peggy is in her living room. That's where it all takes place. So her neighbour's just come in to save the lady who's going to look around the house and offered to go and show her around. And she said to Peggy, now you sit there, don't you move, you sit there and be a good girl, be a good girl. Yes, mother, I can be good. I'll be on my bestest behaviour. So now Peggy is sort of fiddling with things, but no, she's supposed to be good, so she'll stop. I'm still being good. Hello, I'm still being good. I don't know what she wants to look at the house for. It's the same as it ever was. I wish she'd come to Weston, our Lisa. She used to love Weston, our Lisa, paddling in the sea and racing the waves and collecting bits of seaweed and shells and furtling about for all sorts of treasures. And she'd stay in that sea until she were blue with cold and we'd have to warm her up with a cup of tea from the thermos and wrap her in three towels and rub her hands and feet till the colour came back in them. And her with the sand, it were all right to build sandcastles with and scraping a moat together and making a drawbridge out of ice lolly sticks. But when it was time to go, getting that sand off her skin to dress her scream blue moon as she would, people would look at us, stare, like we were child amusers. No, that's not... child abusers, that's what they looked at us like. She was like a magnet to sand, our Lisa, whereas it would brush off our mark and like water off the duck's back. Them were the days. I'm sure I had some mints here somewhere. I'm sure I had some mints. Did she's pinched them? Where are my mints, you tea leaf? Where are my mints?
Well done. <Hello. laughs> Thank you.
See, I'm not an actor. Proven that point. So obviously just from that section, I thought it was good because you've got her reminiscing. So she's actually calm there, apart from when she's shouting at her neighbour. Mm. But she gets her neighbour confused with lots of people. She gets lots of people confused. But when she reminisces, she's very, very calm. So a tactic we used throughout the play was to go, oh, think about when so-and-so. We've got boxes of photos we get her to look through. Look at this one, and it calms her down. You know, they sing hymns together because it calms her down. It takes her back to a time when she could cope. But then you've got things as well, like when Louise sits down for a cup of tea, She, well, the tea is cold, but she goes to put sugar in it, and in the sugar bowl are Peggy's teeth, because that's where she keeps them. And Louisa's like, oh, there's teeth in the bowl. So, and Peggy's like, well, yes, of course, that's my teeth. What do you expect to find?
It's where I keep my teeth, yeah.
Yeah, completely normal. So there's a few things like that that we use as props, and just to disconcert the lady that doesn't know what's going on a bit more, to think, what the hell have I walked into here? But largely it's Peggy's reactions to people, how she fiddles with things. There's a section before this where Louise has gone off to try and ring the estate agent to work out what's going on, and Peggy's picked up Louise's handbag and gone through it and picked out a lipstick and tried it on her hand, don't like that, picked out a tampon, unpacked it and licked it, thinking it's a lollipop, and of course it's not, and then chucked it away. So we've got things that are not particularly, you know, they might happen, I don't know. They're there for
No, I can quite see. I mean,
my man did do some bizarre things. They do. And to them, that's completely normal. She thinks that's a lollipop or something. So
yeah, absolutely. No, I can quite see that. And having had some close contact with people suffering from Alzheimer's, I've seen wallets and purses appearing in the wrong handbag pockets. But not with no intention to steal it, just that the assumption is that must be mine, so I'll pick it up.
And they have no boundaries either. That a lot of the time, as they get further in, their boundaries lessen, and their behaviour becomes comedic because it's inappropriate.
Yeah. Well, well done. That's been really, really interesting and useful. And you must let us know when it's next produced, because I for one will be buying a ticket and getting along there. sounds good.
Well, thank you, Amanda. It's nearly time to wrap up for this week, but before we do, there's just time for Teresa and Kate to tell us what they're reading at the moment. So, Teresa, what's on your bedside table?
Well, I'm currently reading Border, A Journey to the Edge of Europe by Katka Kasabova. Sorry if I've pronounced that incorrectly. This is a book that my daughter bought me for Christmas, and she knows that I'm interested in the Balkans and so on. So I'll just read you from the flyleaf. It says, when Katka Kasabova was a child, the border zone between Bulgaria, Turkey and Greece was rumoured to be an easier crossing point into the West than the Berlin Wall. So it swarmed with soldiers, spies and fugitives. On holidays close to the border on the Black Sea coast, she remembers playing on the beach, only miles from where an electrified fence bristled, its barbs pointing inwards towards the enemy, the holidaymakers, the potential escapees. Today, this densely forested landscape is no longer heavily militarized, but it is scarred by its past. In Border, she sets out on a journey to meet the people of this triple border, Bulgarians, Turks, Greeks, and the latest wave of refugees fleeing conflict further afield. It's a fascinating book. I've about a third of the way into it. And Katka also is a poet, so she writes very beautifully. And I was just going to read a little bit from the preface. This book tells the human story of the last border of Europe. It is where Bulgaria, Greece and Turkey converge and diverge, borders being what they are. It is also where something like Europe begins and something else ends, which isn't quite Asia. This is roughly the geography of it, but the map will only take you so far before you find yourself in the ancestral forest that teems with shadows and lives out of time. That is where I ended up going anyway. It may be that all borderlands hum with the frequencies of the unconscious. After all, borders are where the fabric is thin. However, this border region hums with an especially siren-like tone and distinguishes itself for three reasons. One, because of unfinished business from the Cold War. Two, because it is one of Europe's great wildernesses. And three, because it has been a continental confluence ever since there have been continents. And it's full of anecdotes. She talks about this fire ceremony where people walk on fire, which happens in northern Greece, but she witnesses that in the forest, and people coming from Greece who used to live in what is now Bulgaria but were expelled, and they come back for these ceremonies. Mm. She manages to contact someone who tried to escape from East Germany over the border when he was 18, and she interviews him in Germany, and he's a great well, an artist, and that's fascinating. So it's very anecdotal. It doesn't fit into a neat category of book, but also the wilderness aspect appeals to me as well, because it, as you know, I love walking, and so I'm sort of thinking it might be an interesting area to visit for walking.
Sounds so not fiction.
No, it's not fiction. I should say it's not fiction.
It just sounds interesting. Thank you, Teresa. Kate, what's on your bedside table?
Well, my bedside table, or on my bedside audiobook, is a book called My Life in Parts by Bryan Cranston, the actor. I went for this book. I really love Bryan Cranston. I think he's ace. I've loved him since he was in Malcolm in the Middle, and then obviously he did Breaking Bad. But the reason I picked up this book finally is because I got it as a Christmas present last year, and I thought, well, I'm not going to read that because I don't read books. So I downloaded it on my Audible, and I finally, a year later, got round to listening to it. Oh, the best thing I've learned out of it is this idea of letting go. So he talked about the acting craft, and he talks about how you work really hard at your craft. You build, and then the masters can then just let go. And I love that idea that you work really hard, and then it's actually the art of letting go, you know, that actually makes you great at what you do. And it's so true with all of the work I do with presenters. You know, I sort of say to them at the start, I'm teaching you these rules because at some point you're going to learn when to break them. So, but learn the rules and then you'll learn how to break them.
Mm-hmm.
What he does is he breaks the whole book down into roles that he's played, and that can be father or architect. And he's done some really wild things. He talks about his time in Seinfeld, which I didn't know he was in, and that was a wonderful thing to realise. And he has this great story in there about how he was a murder suspect as well.
Yeah, right.
Really lovely things in there that, you know, if you're a fan of Bryan, then you'll really appreciate.
Yeah, but a good autobiography for anybody that's interested in sort of the drama world, the acting world, and so on. Good.
Yeah, absolutely.
That sounds great.
And I think if you're a fan of Breaking Bad or any work that he's done, it's really, there's quite a lot of Breaking Bad in there, and how he talks about why he chose Breaking Bad over other opportunities. And I think that, to me, just that behind this, it's that peek behind the curtain, isn't it? That I think if you're a fan of Breaking Bad.
Thank you for that. Well, that's the end of Write Club, the podcast for this week. We hope you've enjoyed the show. If you've already subscribed on iTunes or Stitcher, please tell a friend and help us grow. And visit us on our Facebook site. Goodbye till next time.
Bye! Bye.